In this episode of The Critical Myth, the Critical Myth crew preps for another mission with Covert Affairs, debates the merits of Manhattan, conducts experiments with the last ship, prepares for the end of True Blood, and contemplates madness with the leftovers. It's episode 477, the one before DragonCon.
That's right, we are back with episode 477 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I'm not sure. I think I might have been stuck in a cabin in the woods. Not that cabin in the woods, though.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm really not allowed to talk about anything that I've done, so don't ask.
Yeah, and we are, well, as this airs... some of us are doing our last final preparations for going off to Dragon Con, or at least in Bronzethumb's case, he's already on his way and possibly there. We don't know. We'll find out, I suppose, in the morning. But yeah, we're probably going to be closing our week out here with this episode, since it will be the holiday weekend coming up. And obviously, we won't have an episode early next week, as we'll all still be in Atlanta. And we might have, though, something to offer later in the week, but basically around the Labor Day weekend, we are taking off a little bit of time to all get together as a group. God help Atlanta. But we are going to go ahead, though, and cover some of the shows that we are still up to date on. We're actually a little behind on some shows, which is fine, because we're getting into that point where there's things ending and we're waiting for shows to premiere, and every year it seems like the premiere dates are thrown further and further back to either the end of September or mid-October in some cases. So we've got a little bit of time to play catch up once we're back from Dragon Con. But before we go any further, Edmund, why don't you go ahead and give a disclaimer?
Absolutely. When we talk about the few things we do have time to talk about, we will always talk about everything that happened in the episode. So you will be horribly spoiled, but come on, there's not that much that we're watching right now. We've all had time to catch up, haven't we?
I would hope so. If not, well... You'll have the entire weekend to get over it. So, all right. Well, before we continue to just babble about these things, Gary, I guess we should start with you. What show would you like to discuss first?
Oh, geez, John, I want to talk about Annie and Covert Affairs. I don't know why we have all these other TV shows in the first place. When obviously take precedent.
You make a compelling point. Let's go ahead and run the promo.
Next Tuesday.
So McQuaid lied.
The only question is how deep those lies go.
Has Annie put her trust?
Are you emotionally involved with him?
My head's in the game.
In the wrong hands?
He doesn't know I'm investigating him.
We can't have these secrets between us.
Annie, I think he's playing you.
Covert Affairs, an all-new episode next Tuesday at 10 on USA.
All right, Dan, if you could.
Absolutely. We're speaking about Covert Affairs, Season 5, Episode 9, Spit on a Stranger. Annie initiates an undercover mission without CIA support while Calder interrogates Augie regarding a breach of protocol. Meanwhile, a new recruit arrives at McQuaid Security.
Hmm. And what would you give this one?
I would give this an 8.
Okay. Edmund?
I'd say I'm good with an 8 as well.
All right. And same here. It seems as though this was a very consistent reaction from all of us. Gary, go ahead. Get us started. This is your favorite, after all.
Is it obvious? Anyway, yes, we're talking about this episode, and it's nice that it's not a standalone episode. This whole season, I think more so than some of them, you know, is continuing to be just this one ongoing storyline. The episodes really don't stand that well by themselves. They overlap back and forth to a significant degree, more so than I think they have in the past. And we're continuing on with this story about, you know, Annie not being physically able because of her heart condition to be able to be in the field. She's still sort of going out on her own to do things. In this case, she's following up on this hunch and reasonable hunch that McQuaid's dirty, and she's going without CIA approval because she is still suspended, I believe, at this point. And Augie is still backing her up, and this is starting to get Augie into trouble as well. And that's one of the things that sort of stuck with me a little bit was the whole Calder angle on this. Did you guys find it sort of out of character? I couldn't quite put my finger on what I didn't like about the Calder-Augie dynamic in this episode, but it just didn't feel right to me. What did you guys think about that particular part before we go further?
Yeah, well, it feels like all season they've been kind of struggling to plug Calder into the rest of the team, and it's reminding me a little bit, although I mean it's different character beats, but of some of the problems with integrating Joan and Arthur earlier on in the series. It's interesting. It seems to be that once they get someone up into the upper echelons of the CIA, they can't quite figure out how to navigate between that being their superior and actually giving them support especially the way it's playing out, I'm finding it in increasingly difficult to see what point the whole Call Girl thing had to do other than just giving Calder a plot line. But
I agree. It definitely feels sort of tacked on this season.
Yeah, it did seem a little bit tacked on, but at the same time, I feel like they're still, and maybe even more than ever, trying to play up this whole question of who could be the mole working with the postman. And I really feel like the whole point of having the call girl there was to add another red herring into the whole mix. And it's only as they're getting to the point where they're really honing in on who could be betraying everybody that they've kind of peeled away the people that are less and less likely or so forth. But other than that, walking plot device, yeah. I don't think she had any other real purpose.
Well, anyway, to continue on with the sort of summary of the episode, surprise, surprise, Annie goes to work for McQuaid Security. I think everybody on the show saw this coming episodes away. And she seems to be getting in close, and she starts to dig and dig and even enlists Arthur's help at one point, and he's sort of reticent. And it's sort of interesting to see the professional dynamics even without the CIA structure. Arthur saying, before I help you, you have to read me in, very much a company term, but at the same time, he's still using it, and the implications therein lie. So it's sort of that's sort of nice to see that they still have that professional relationship while they've of course risked each other lives for each other. There's still that professionalism about them and the job that they're trying to do, which I thought was a nice little touch. Anyway, she goes down, ends up meeting with McQuaid's assistant, whose name I never can quite remember. And they end up catching one or two of the guys from this secret op unit that Annie's discovered. And then just when we feel that, okay, she's got McQuaid dead to rights, he turns around without any prompting and basically dumps all the information that she's discovered and admits to it all to some extent. So it sort of really leaves us in a quandary. Did he find out she knows? Did is he really honest? He's become an even more nebulous character. He seemed to be sort of opening up where we thought he was a bad guy. Now they're really introducing a pretty good bit of doubt into my mind. Are you guys sold? Is he the devil, or is he just misunderstood?
I feel like they did a very effective job of putting the crosshairs on him until this episode. And now I am once again thinking that it's either his second in command, the woman whose name we can never remember.
Caitlin, but anyway.
Who?
Caitlin.
Caitlin. Okay. I'm trying to. But at any rate, Perry Reeves. her character. She still seems to me, it's got to be her or Haley. But they've done a very nice job of every time I really feel like that they've made it clear that it's one of those two of distracting me with other things and throwing out extraneous pieces of information in the right order to keep me from really being sure about my conclusions. But I don't know, Gary, Edmund, are those your two top suspects too, or do you feel like there might be other people in the running?
Yeah, I mean, I think given the amount of misdirection, and I actually thought they did a very good job of targeting McQuaid, and then that final scene when he comes clean and is saying he's being set up, and that whole thing of trying to get Annie to rely on her instincts. I was taken aback by that, and to the point where I was believing him. So it, I think the other suspects out there, Caitlin seems the most obvious, but then I think we've gotten caught up in this before with this show where we think, oh no, it's too obvious, but then we discover that no, they aren't going to go quite that subtle and complex. So yeah, I'd say my money's on Caitlin.
Okay. How about you, Gary? Who's your top suspect at this point?
I still want to say it's McQuaid. He gave a good speech, and even the whole storyline really pushed for his innocence. But at the same time, I wonder, did he discover Annie broke into those files? Because the way he sort of regurgitated every piece of information that he had discovered seemed almost a little too convenient. He didn't leave any stone unturned in his innocence.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, we've, as usual, they, I believe, are coming to a mid-season break with the next episode, so I imagine we'll find out. It's okay. We know that it's at least coming back for the rest of the season later this year. So
I don't think it renewed after one episode like every other show. Anyway.
Well, I mean, part of the problem is that this season has had much lower ratings than previously, which is very surprising to me. I can't imagine that many people left the series because they felt like it didn't have any place to go after Wilcox was taken care of. I don't think that many viewers out there are so wedded to a storyline. The only show where I think that's really a danger is maybe Homeland, but even then I expect most people to still come back to at least see what it looks like. So I'm a little surprised that it's as lowly rated as it is this summer. I don't know what's going on there, but eh. It's not like USA has a ton of established shows to keep running right now, so I would hope it would go at least another couple seasons. It's not sci-fi. USA usually spools it out to at least season 6 or 7, right? I mean, come on, Burn Notice made it that far.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, Jesus, if that could make it, yeah.
Psych made it that far. All right, so that being said, Edmund, what should be our next topic?
Why don't we delve into Manhattan?
All right, and we're going to be talking about one episode from a couple weeks ago, so this one I hope everybody is up to date on.
Certainly. This is Manhattan, Season 1, Episode 3, The Hive. The loss of one of their own leaves the community reeling, and new security measures interfere with the work being performed by the scientists.
All right, and what would you give this one?
I will give this one a 7.5.
All right, and Gary, how about you?
I'm going to go 8.5.
All right. Let's see. Give this one a little bit of thought. I'm going to go with a 7.5 as well. But to be honest, I'm not as committal on that because it didn't really... I'm kind of falling on that because it didn't do a lot to... The show has really been at 7.5 for me the entire way. So it's still not doing anything to really distinguish itself on my end, but it's not really a topic that's near and dear to me like it is to you guys. So, Gary, you clearly came in the highest this week and a big jump up from last episode, which you were very disappointed with. So what was the turnaround, do you think, this time?
The main character, is it Frank? I the acting really came through for me in this episode. I enjoyed that he was not so much moping and grumbling, but sort of, you know, really pushing to move forward. I enjoyed his action stance as opposed to his just sort of getting beat up with all the different things that were occurring to him. I enjoyed the Frank talk about the person who died the previous episode. We got to see sort of the effect from several different point of views when Frank's wife was actually talking to the guy who shot him and didn't realize that he had shot him. And the look of horror that came upon her face and the whole situation, I thought was very well played. It really seemed to mesh the sort of frustration of the boy genius character, I guess, that's working on with the other team right now was refreshing. That, you know, basically, you know, what was his line? I don't know what you guys have been doing for the past 3 months, and yes, he solves every problem in about 30 seconds. This episode seemed to be full of good moments for me. The main character getting arrested so he can meet with the superior officer because he couldn't get an appointment any other way. I just thought they were being very creative with the episode, and I think they should be, you know, rewarded for it with a good score.
And how about you, Edmund?
Yeah,
your thoughts on this?
Yeah, for me, I mean, my lower score was primarily because I'm feeling a bit of frustration with the way they seem to be just constantly putting up the roadblocks, to my mind, for the sake of dramatic tension. I agree in terms of with some of the acting has still been top rate. That scene that Gary was mentioning when Olivia Williams, Frank's wife, is talking to the young private. You know, what was wonderful about it was that look of horror was as much her both in terms of what he had done, but also realizing how much guilt he was feeling. You know, what had driven him to come to Frank's house and try and atone. So some marvelous work being done, and also the commander who I still can't, you know, even though it's hard for me to think of him as anything other than Duck Phillips from Mad Men, but that whole opening scene with the private where he's so worried about anybody overhearing that he has him meet him in the middle of his morning swim, because that's the safest place to basically to pull off a bit of a cover up about the shooting, so that, you know, there were some nice beats, I think my major issue, I mean, it's something that's very, very specific and personal to me, which I know I've mentioned in the previous episodes, of where it's just in terms of the way the bomb teams were developed, it just seems way too over the top having them have this many obstacles. And I think given the built-in tensions between the army and the security in positions and scientists who want to be able to share information because that's the way they work on things, and the actors and characters they've developed, they don't need that extra dramatic tension on top of it.
Yeah. I'm still trying to get a feel for this show. There are times when it feels like it is overly indulgent in its pacing, in its slow pacing, I should say. And there are other times where I feel like I can sense that they are maybe breaking out of their mold. There were some scenes in this particular episode where they were actually fairly funny, and I was surprised to see that sense of humor shine through when there hadn't been a whole lot of evidence of it previously. I'm hoping they don't take the entire season to do that, though. But again, this is not a topic that is really automatically appealing to me, so I'm really looking for those character interactions to win the day. And I guess part of the problem for me is that the show is relying a little bit, or not relying, but is held back a little bit by the fact that a lot of the characters, there's a sameness to them still. I don't know if I could even point out names other than Frank and a couple other people, especially the supporting female cast, not Olivia Williams, but some of the others. I still have a hard time distinguishing between them when they're not in context with their spouses or significant others or fathers in some cases. So, which is kind of a criticism, because I would like to see the female characters stand on their own a little bit more. I know that it was probably time appropriate for them to be somewhat defined by their male counterparts, but I don't know that it works for me as an audience member.
Yeah, and actually, that's one of the things that I know in some of the lead up to the show that was being focused on, that they were going to be dealing with the family side of things. And at the moment, other than Olivia Williams' character, who's being very deliberately set up as she wasn't the conventional housewife. She was this biologist and a professor in her own right. And at the moment, all of the other wives are being set up as, yes, just these stereotypical housewives of, you know, yes, successful men, but that it there. I mean, I expected there to be a little more differentiation shown there, and I'm hoping once they get away from all of this setup of the teams and the security, and that they can start perhaps delving into that a little bit more.
Mm. Yeah, hopefully so. Gary, anything more to add to this particular one?
No, but I see Edmund's point that it does still seem like they're holding back on some of the characterizations, and they're trying to, you know, I get the sense they're trying to, you know, show us these characters and give us a sense of how they tick, but they need more of an event, I guess, to do so. I guess this death was supposed to do that, but it didn't involve, I felt, enough people to, you know, give us a whole sense of the townsfolk to distinguish them more. So I guess they're going to need some other event or something, some sort of impetus to show us that. And this unfortunately didn't work. While I thought that was where they were going, it's they focused on a few individuals instead of the whole general camp, it seemed.
Hmm. Well, again, it's still early in, so we have to see what this is going to look like in terms of the rest of the season. But like I said, I feel like it's off to a little bit of a slow start, but opinions are clearly diverging. All right, Gary, it is your choice again. So what would you like to move on to?
I would like to go talk about The Last Ship.
All right, sounds good to me. Let's go ahead and run the promo.
With just 2 episodes left this season.
Let's finish what we started.
A cure is within reach.
Infect the crew with the virus, you see what happens.
Doc, we got a problem.
But at what cost?
Who did I think I was? That I could solve this?
The Last Ship. All new TNT next Sunday at 9. Or watch on demand.
All right, and if you could do the recap.
Absolutely. We're talking about The Last Ship. Season 1, Episode 9, Trials. Volunteers are asked to participate in human trials of Rachel's vaccine, but the effects could be nightmarish. Meanwhile, back in the States, Chandler's wife and father struggle to keep their family alive. I would give this episode a 9.
All right. And Edmund?
I will actually go 7.5.
Oh, interesting. All right. And I would give this an 8.5. We're all over the map here. All right. Gary, highlights.
I thought that we're this close to a cure this early in the series is very interesting. It sort of, for me, foreshadowing the point that this show is not going to be all and end all virus cure, which is great because I don't know how long you can support that before people get bored or malaised over it. So I'm glad they're ending that sooner than later, or at least so it seems. I enjoyed the fact that as a what I would assume would be a hint, we're starting to see what the world looks like. The captain's father was giving us a reasonable amount of exposition without, I felt, choking us with it. Talking about how there were all the myths on how to avoid or cure yourself of the virus when it was coming through, how when he ran across that group that actually caught the virus, that, you know, they're spraying X's on the houses. Obviously, this is something they've had to do before and are well aware of. So you get a sense of the virus culture that's existing on land, and it seems so stark in comparison to the good life they're having aboard the ship. That I wonder what's going to happen when they do finally come on land and I guess try to facilitate and spread the cure. So I'm guessing that's where the show is going to go, and I'm looking forward to the chance to be off ship for a while. So we'll see where that goes. But overall, I'd say this was really nice. There were some very, you know, tender moments. I thought I don't think she was a yeoman, or I'm not sure if she was an officer or not, but the list of personnel was pregnant was, I thought, a little bit of an over-the-top thing for this episode.
Yes.
And this show, I know, is guilty of that from time to time, and I sort of had to, you know, wince a little bit when I really, you know, they were going for the heartstring that hard. But overall, I'd say it was a nice episode. I even enjoyed the Master Chief sort of, I don't know, religious destiny that he felt he had. I thought they played it well without going too crazy with it, so it was good. I enjoyed it a lot. I enjoyed the the number of volunteers they had that wanted to go ahead and do it. So I thought this was a very great, good episode. I couldn't find much weakness in it besides the pregnancy, you know, tugging at the heartstrings issue. So that's why I rated it highly. John, what was your strong point for you of this episode?
I really liked the fact that they're going as far as they are in terms of trying to push for this cure. And while I had every reason to believe that they were actually going to get something out of it at the end, I honestly didn't know how many of them would survive. There was a point where I really thought that they were going to kill off the young woman who turned out to be pregnant. And I thought that would have been a really shocking move for them to take, really extremely dark. And they hinted that that's exactly what was happening when they cut the commercial at that point. And I remember looking at it and just going, did they really go there? Because that – I could actually believe that they would. Obviously that's not the way that it turned out because, you know, the realistic thing is that this isn't really that kind of show. But just the fact that they even flirt with it was impressive. Just the fact that they took it as far as they did. You had that sense of danger throughout. I didn't get upset by the subplot with the family because as much as it was clear to me that the ham radio or whatever that he was using, it was certainly an older model. I thought it was funny that the captain's wife thought that she would just go to an electronics store and find a vacuum tube, but all that aside, just it's very clear to me that they're going to capture the radio transmission and hear that the family is sick, and so of course the cure has to be available and they're going to be racing against time to get to the family. But I have every reason to believe that the Russian ship is going to overhear the exact same transmission as they're in the midst of dying and therefore even more desperate to get to the Nathan James and to the cure. So it felt like a logical plot device that they've referenced the fact that the family is out there previously in the show. So they've done the foreshadowing that they needed to do. Was it a little bit hokey? Yes. But, you know, in a way, I thought there were some nice subtleties in how, like, yes, the mother uses her spit to wipe off the face of the kid because that's what moms do, even though she knows she's infected. Well, your first thought is, why in the world would you do that? And then the second thought is they've been living with this thing for how many months? They know when it's over and done. She knows it's already too late. So it was kind of interesting to see that and think about that. Even as I recognize that they did play things up a little bit on that end. But Edmund, I'm kind of curious as to why you kind of gave it a lower score than the two of us did. What didn't work for you?
Well, it's still a 7.5, still above average, or just above average. But for me, even though I agree, they did introduce a few subtleties and some decent misdirection in the trials. Still felt to me a little bit by the numbers, especially when they had so many of the main characters in that isolation tent. It just felt to me preordained that, you know, given the way it's been set up, that they're not going to have the vaccine fail and have everybody die of the virus. So I think they did introduce some nice twists and turns. Although to me the pregnancy was just going a little bit too far. I really felt more this sense of an episode that was more just putting things in place and setting things up for the final episodes to come. So not that I didn't enjoy it, but it just it was more just a kind of prelude episode and getting some things in place for the finales. However, I do feel the especially once they introduce that thing at the end of, you know, no, I've actually found the cure. I do have to be the stand-in for Bronsum to say, yes, in fact, they are remaking Crusade now. So they are going to cure the virus, and now it's all going to be about the ramifications and where it came from and what happened within these governments that have fallen in the interim. So which sounds actually rather interesting. So if that's the direction they go in, I just felt this was just a little way station along the way.
It could certainly be, and that's the fun part, is that by resolving the issue right away, we know they have a second season coming. So now it's like, oh, what is it even going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they go the perhaps obvious route and have the virus mutate, that's just going to be doubling down on it, and it's just going to be repetitive. But I like the idea that this is really the only remaining command structure left.
Yeah.
And do anything. They've got the weaponry. They've got everything else. So what they've got to be the lead on whatever is going to be trying to bring things back together. And that, you know, sets up, of course, the Russian commander as the antagonist in a completely different sense. So, you know, as much as I was joking before about the, you know, I'm kind of getting the Crusade vibe out of this, I don't know. Maybe we'll actually be getting some of the same themes more than we thought that we would.
Yeah, it also occurs to me, especially when you're bringing up them going in a completely different direction in the second season. We already mentioned the odd parallels to Helix at the very beginning of the show, starting up in the Arctic. And now, if that is in fact what's happening, it's another intriguing parallel, since Helix is going in a completely different direction in its second season, but it seems that Last Ship is still doing it better than they did. So.
Well, in the first episode of the second season of The Last Ship, they will resolve whatever problem there is on Helix so that we can have can just cancel Helix and get it out of our misery.
Yes,
I think that makes perfect sense. All right. Let's see. Anything more that you want to say on this one, Gary?
No. I just think it's they're handling it very practically, and there aren't many issues that I have to sort of, you know, turn my brain off to accept for the storyline, which is nice. You know, as you mentioned Helix before, I had to shut my brain off many times to make that show continue to work for me. This one I can usually keep it running. I think they're generally making logical choices and decisions, and it makes sense. So that's another, you know, facet of the show that intrigues me.
Very cool. All right, Edmund, I believe you have the next topic to choose from. Unless you would like to have us take a look at this list of quick hits and see which ones we can actually discuss. Did any of you guys happen to catch the pilot for Legends?
I did, of course. It involves spies. I had to check it out.
I know. I figured. I just wasn't sure.
No, but I was disappointed to see that the pilot was named Pilot.
And Sean Bean survived the pilot.
Yes.
I was a little shocked by that.
Well,
I'm not used to it. So this is Legends, obviously, like you said, Gary, Season 1, Episode 1 pilot. Just to do this correctly, deep undercover agent Martin Odom, Sean Bean, tries to reconnect with his estranged family following an assignment, but he must return to work when a terror group announces an imminent attack in the premiere of this drama series based on the spy novelist Robert Littell's book. Edmund, what would you give this?
For a pilot, I will give it a solid 7.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of where I landed as well. I have my pros and cons, but I'll let you go ahead and get us started.
Yeah.
Just briefly. We don't need to get into too much detail.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the actual spy work was kind of by the numbers, and they are trying to introduce mystery element of the guy following Sean Bean around and finally cornering him, or Sean Bean finally corners him, and we get the infamous "Are you really who you say you are? Don't trust anyone," which we certainly have heard many times before, and I think the success of the series is going to depend on how they spool that out. But the other thing that just did deeply amuse me that they have Ali Larder there as the head of his division, who doesn't really like him because he doesn't play by the book, but they still manage to get her masquerading as a stripper within 20 minutes. So it's kind of Heroes Season 1 all over again.
Really not seeing the problem here.
not that there's a problem, but I just found it. I just found it deeply amusing.
Oh, it was. It was definitely amusing because I was sitting there thinking to myself, really? She's practically doing the exact same thing she did in the pilot for Heroes. But
yes.
Okay. Sure. Whatever works. So I have to say, just as a premise goes, I like the premise. I like Sean Bean in this show. I really don't have any problems there at all. if I have one misgiving about this, it's that the pilot presents that part of the reason why he's having a hard time coming back into his real life, so to speak, is that he spent 6 months in this other, you know, cover personality, and he's having a hard time adjusting back into his true personality and his true self. And of course they're introducing this idea that if you do that enough times, you start losing the sense of who you are,
mm-hmm.
because you have to be so convincing and convince yourself that you are this person in your deep cover identity. My concern is that that's great as a maybe like a once-off premise, because then how are they going to do this weekly? Is it going to be skipping months at a time every episode? Because then that's going to get a little bit crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, he's either that or he's currently in his present day really on a psychological brink, which could work, but at the same time, it's like I need there to have been more of a trigger to that than just this latest mission, which didn't seem like it was that intensive. So there's still some open question for me about how they're going to take this premise that works really, really well from a one-off situation and make it the series.
Yeah, I mean, I got the impression more that what they were attempting to do with the psychologist reports was that it wasn't just this one mission, but this has been the ongoing thing. He's our best undercover operative, but the problem is he always gets in too deep, and presumably that's why his family his marriage has fallen apart, and he's estranged from his family, and that it wasn't just this one mission, that it's just part of his broken psyche. But again, I mean, like with the whole conspiracy mystery part, I mean, it's the series is really going to hang on how they play that out. So we will see.
Yes, I suppose we will. All right. Also, we have here Falling Skies, Season 4, Episode 9, Till Death Do Us Part. Tom and a team trek the Vulm in an attempt to find equipment to work on a crippled airship. Meanwhile, Maggie and Ben inch closer together at camp while Pope and Sarah clash. And I thought this was the penultimate episode for the season, and I was disappointed to learn there's three more after this. It's really sad when a promising premise becomes a little bit of a chore to get through, but there's a reason this is in the quick hits again after the hopes that this season would kind of get off to a better start. Did you guys happen to catch up on this one?
No, I did not.
Nope. Slacker. How about you, Gary?
No, we were just slacking together, sitting in the corner there.
Just fine. I'm taking the one for the team then on this one. For the most part, it was exactly what we've come to expect. Everybody was kind of bickering and so forth, and they've introduced this love triangle mm-hmm. between Maggie, Matt, and Hal, which is way overdone. And the only way that they could make it work was to basically have the spines or the partial spine that was taken from Matt and given to Maggie in order for her to heal has now linked them together in an intrinsic fashion. And the thing that kind of bothered me, and I'm giving it a 6, by the way, is that there are some pretty major questions about agency that are getting skirted around here, because while Matt's emotions are fairly driven from his side of the equation, Maggie is kind of having to deal with her own emotions and the spillover of his. And there are times when it's obvious that they're implying that she's reacting more to what he's feeling than what she's actually feeling, and it's overwhelming to her, and she's not freaking out about it. And I feel like they're completely skirting the issue of the fact that this was basically done to her against her will. And what does that mean? They're really completely overlooking that. And I feel like it's going to get into some really disturbing directions if they don't sooner or later get into it a lot more than they did in the episode. So that's what bothered me there. But at any rate, I'm not really spoiling anything. They pretty much show that right in the right in the promo that's where they're going. I got the sense again that I'm the only one that's currently up to date on Outlander.
Right, so, again. Yes.
All right.
You are a genius, John.
I try. How about Extant, guys? Anyone else up to date on Extant? Or at least on one of these?
Afraid not.
Do you care if I spoiled it at all?
Nope, not at all.
Has it gotten better?
No. Okay. Accident, Season 1, Episode 5, What on Earth is Wrong? What a perfect place to start. John begins to doubt Molly's mental state when the validity of her pregnancy is questioned. Meanwhile, Ethan suffers a serious setback, and John and Julie disagree over how to care for him. My main thing here is that they just had this showdown that clearly demonstrated that Molly's boss and that entire organization was working a conspiracy of silence and threatening her and her family, and yet they go back to basically just working for them again. It makes no sense whatsoever to me. I'm kind of glossing over it a little bit because clearly she still has some concerns and suspicions, and it's mostly so that she can figure out what's going on by kind of playing nice, but it just doesn't make sense to me, and of course everybody's pretending that there was never anything wrong in the first place. I give this a 6. They did kind of explain that the alien presence, I'm assuming alien presence, is some kind of nanotech kind of thing going on, or at least nano-sized life. It's not, it's kind of unclear, but there we are. We also have Season 1, Episode 6, Nightmare. Molly uncovers top-secret footage that reveals the real reason the ISEA chose her for the solo space mission. Meanwhile, Ethan experiences his first dream, an unforeseen event for which he is not programmed, and Julie connects with a mysterious man she meets at a gym. The one takeaway that I have here is that it is revealed that there was a previous mission, something got to them, and they all wound up basically either killing each other or dying while they were up there in the mission. And the one person on the mission was the daughter of the guy who's in charge of the organization. So there is at least some compelling mystery in the rough of all of this that's keeping me from going much below a 6. But I have to say there is an awful lot of stuff going on that I just don't care about. And I would love to take Ethan, and no offense to the kid who's playing the role, throw him into a garbage disposal. because this whole android exploration of artificial intelligence and all is going nowhere. From what I can see, it's just, I get the theme. I get that they're exploring life that is not human and what the interactions with that might be, but they're doing it in such a poor fashion that it's very, I'm a couple of episodes behind and I kind of struggle to even think about going any further. And I know that you're still not quite up on this episode of The Musketeers because I interrupted you while you were watching it in order
to get
started.
Yes, I got exiled from the Exiles.
Yes, that's okay, though. All right, so that leaves a couple shows here left for us to discuss, and I'm going to go ahead then and start with True Blood. Gary, you're up on this one?
Yes, sir, I am.
Oh, good. All right, let's go ahead and run the promo.
What do you mean you don't want it?
She's your fate. She is your destiny.
It's our light that pulls us in, just as she is pulled to our darkness.
I came for Sugi.
You can come inside if you want.
Death, that's what we are. That's all we can give her.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Absolutely. We're talking about True Blood, Season 7, Episode 9, Love is to Die. Hoyt's reminded of his past while Bill continues to push Sookie away. Sam makes a difficult choice, and Eric faces a dilemma when he's caught in a lie.
Hmm. And what would you give this?
I think I actually have to go with a 9, John.
A 9?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. I would probably go with more of a 7.
Oh.
And let's see. I did fail to see what Nadine gave this one, but I'll follow up with that in a moment. But Gary, 9.
Wow. Nadine gave it good numbers because he's a smart man. Anyway, he's been loving this season, and I thought this was an exceptionally good episode, and that 9 is still within the category of this show. Independently, it might not go that high, but for this show, I thought this episode came together really well. We had Hoyt getting back together with Jessica. The best moment of this particular episode was Sookie reading Sam's goodbye letter, I guess you'd call it, with the sort of the flashback as he's starting to pack up and explain his choices of why he decided to leave. And even though it's home, he's got to do what his girlfriend wants to do for the best interest of the child. And I thought it was an incredibly good scene, even for this show. It really felt like almost somebody else was writing it. It came together so well, at least for me, that I liked it so much. We had Eric, who we feel knows everything and has everything together, but this Japanese guy is, seems like he's playing him like a cheap fiddle, which is sort of ground that Eric is not used to having to tread. And it's interesting to see how he is constantly getting caught off balance, as if this guy's like one step ahead of him all the time. And I'm enjoying that shakeup for Eric as well throughout all this. And we also had an explanation from Bill of why he's choosing to die. And while it wasn't the best explanation in the world, it helped make a little bit more sense. And I like the heart to heart that he and Eric had. So I have to say, for an episode of True Blood, it usually doesn't get much better than this.
Nadine gave this one a 7.5, which is in fact a bit of a an improvement on the last few episodes from his perspective. So I'll grant that much at the very least. I just haven't been particularly impressed by anything that they've done since the middle of the season. They had a good run of about 3 episodes, and since then they've fallen back into the bad habits that they had earlier this season, and I really feel like this just never went anywhere.
Well, it feels like they're closing up shop, I don't deny.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is that it feels like a long... They never really gave this season much of a purpose other than to close things out. So this episode really just feels like prepping for the end for some characters. And like you said, Bill's whole decision, while they're committing to it, doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. And if the flashbacks all season long have been leading him to this conclusion, I don't know that they really were convincing enough to make the audience, or at least me, feel like it was a logical decision on his part. I don't see the thread of his thought process there. I will give credit, though. You were talking about, I think, the whole thing with Jason, Hoyt, and Jessica, which, surprisingly enough, while Hoyt and Jessica are having their reunion, Jason and Bridget are having their discussion, which I never thought that a discussion with a woman trying to explain to Jason how it's okay to interact with a woman without trying to sleep with her would actually wind up being the best part of an episode. That says an awful lot. It still just feels like it's just trying to push the characters where they need to go rather than letting the characters organically get there. And that's where I kind of had a problem with it. It just feels forced, the whole thing. It's clear to me that the new writing staff after Alan Ball left had many other ideas of where to go with this stuff and never really intended for last season to lead into a final stretch of episodes. So I think they just were left with really a need to go off course and just spool out these last few episodes to come to a conclusion. And so, like I said, it doesn't feel organic to me. So I just, I don't know. I was struggling while I was watching it to really feel anything about the end of this show.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I agree. It doesn't have an overarching plot at this point. Or storyline, I guess the closest would be Eric's with the cure for Hep V, but even then it's taking a backseat to everything else, so it's not some sort of overriding point to it. We've had several deaths of major characters throughout this season, so I won't disagree with you that it by no means is moving anything forward.
Right. Well, I'll just say this much too. I think part of it is that there was some doubt as to whether how the show was going to come back towards the end of last season, and it almost felt like they could have ended last season and just stopped instead of doing this time jump that they did in the finale last year. And now that seems even more pointless in retrospect. So it's almost like I feel like they're a season beyond where they could have perhaps brought it to a close. And it would have been with a little more grace. But that's it for True Blood then, until next time when we will be talking about the series finale. But Edmund, I think we have an episode of The Leftovers. Are you up to date on this one?
Absolutely.
All right, let's go ahead then and run the promo.
What do you think about the 14th of October?
The great vanishing, the sudden departure?
I mean, come on. What else is there to think about?
I need you to tell me everything that happened last night.
This was all your idea.
Why do you carry a gun?
What?
You taking a nap?
Did something stupid. I don't know what's happening to me.
Do you know what he's doing? You can't let him!
Okay, and if you could please do the recap.
Certainly. This is The Leftovers, Season 1, Episode 8, Cairo. Kevin wonders if his grip on reality is slipping after falling into a difficult situation with Patty, the leader of the Guilty Remnant. Meanwhile, Meg loses her cool during another encounter with Matt. Jill wants Amy to explain her relationship with Kevin, and Nora shows Lori that she won't back down.
Mm-hmm. And what would you give this one?
I will give this a 7.5.
Okay, and I wound up giving it an 8. So we weren't too far off on that one. But I gotta say, I found it a little bit difficult week after week to... Obviously, for those who are over on the VOG Network site... It's been a while since I've written a review for it, because I've just found it hard to get my head around it. What I really liked about this episode, and I almost gave it above that before landing on an 8, I really liked about it is that it fully commits at this stage of the game the idea that Kevin is an incredibly unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Because the end result of this episode is that he's at the very least schizophrenic, if not living a multiple personality disorder. And it throws into question everything about what happens when he blacks out, because we now have absolute proof that that's what happens. He clearly is a different person that interacts with Dean than he is when he's in quote-unquote awake or daytime state. And it throws a lot of question out there in terms of Jill's very pointed and realistic question of perhaps not the best way of approaching it, but accusing Amy of maybe having an affair with her father.
Which they have certainly been hinting at. So we've discussed it. It was nice to see it addressed so head on, even though yes, it wasn't in terms of. Ways you'd want to bring it up. It's not the way you'd want to do it, but it was kind of refreshing.
I'm not entirely sure that her answer was honest,
mm-hmm.
because she kind of did what a lot of people do when they want to deflect and be defensive and pushed it back onto Jill, but she never really struck me as the kind of character that would react in that way when accused of something ludicrous. She just kind of waltzes through life, it seems, with this embrace of the absurdity of it all, and never really takes anything all that seriously. And for her to react the way that she did made me think that she's been enjoying messing with Kevin's head and never thought she'd actually have to face it down in any real way. Because if we grant the fact that Kevin is having these blackout experiences and perhaps his memories of dreams are kind of hinting at what he's been doing, clearly Amy has mentioned entire hours worth of things that have happened that he doesn't remember that she was involved with, like the whole thing with the dog and other stuff. And it's like, fine. So we know that there's stuff that they've done, even if we don't get into the sexual angle of it, there's stuff that they've done that has that no one talks about.
Mm-hmm.
So it really makes me wonder just how, what the heck has been going on? But that's the whole point, is that it's like now it really gets interesting because it's not a mystery per se. It's just how deep does this go? And that's what I find really intriguing about it.
So yeah.
That's
and
where I came in on at an 8, but at any rate.
Yeah, and I guess for me, it my 7.5, my sort of my hesitation in trying to figure it out was just I am starting to get a little frustrated at the sort of the catch-all episodes, and you know, as opposed to the, even though there've only been the two of them, the single focus episodes, to where perhaps this is the intent, where it's just meant to be more scattershot and throwing the audience off balance somewhat, and I think the other thing that just really felt the loss of Patty at the end because you know, and Out has been so extraordinary throughout the entire season, and you know, doing this wonderful acting when she can't speak, and then when she does get to speak, being even better. So after having had this entire episode where she's tied up in this cabin and nobody else is around, so she feels she can just be jabbing at Kevin verbally the entire time, to have her then make that sacrifice at the end was just a real blow, I thought. But
it was, but I think it actually did a lot to justify her character's actions up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side of exposing just how deep Kevin's psychosis was is that Patty's reaction to it says so much about the guilty remnant that has been kind of hinted but hasn't really been said. And basically what it is that 95 to 99% of the people involved with the guilty remnant are just a bunch of freaking childish idiots. And I'm being blunt about it, but really, they're acting like teenagers. They went through a trauma, they don't want to cope, and so they're acting out in these really immature ways. And they're upset that other people are not as upset in the same way that they are. And they just can't handle that. And so they're doing and acting out against these people who have tried to move on in some really cruel and just unnecessary ways. I mean, because obviously they've pretty much spelled out the big thing that the guilty remnant's going to do. And it's just completely unnecessary. There is no reason for them to be doing what they're going to do. And it just, it's like, what are you trying to accomplish? I mean, what do teenagers do, or at least childish adults even do, when they want to just punish the other person? They don't speak. They clam up, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So that's exactly the impression that I get. It makes perfect sense for Jill to go over there at the end, because that's what she's been acting like this whole time too, and everyone thinks she's a brat. Well, guess what? She's going and hanging out with people that are acting just like she is.
Right.
Except for Patty. Patty, I think, is the one person out of the guilty remnant and the one that actually is truly trying to embrace that nihilism that the guilty remnant is trying to portray. She gets that darkness. She actually believes in it. And I think that's why she was in a leadership role. It's why she was willing to sacrifice. Because, I mean, there's another thing, too. Oh, we all wear white and we destroy our old lives, but funny how we actually want to be remembered for this thing that we do. Really? Talk about emo. But she is like, no, we're going to make a statement, whether they know it or not. You know, this is what it's going to be. And what I think happened was that she saw in Kevin almost like that perfect expression of what she was trying to embrace and didn't find in everybody else in her movement. I don't know if I'm really saying that in any coherent way, but the way that she kept on pressing him at the end and saying, you know, you understand,
mm-hmm.
is like she saw like the only way that it could end was for him to destroy her, because that's how it had to be, because he was a more perfect version of what she was trying to embrace than she was.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it was like when it kind of went there, I was like, wow, okay, that's committing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
startling to me.
Certainly, it wasn't that I wasn't kind of expecting it the way that they were leading up to it, and it certainly resonated with the reveal of the stoning of Gladys being self-inflicted, or being done by the group, which I'd heard speculation on, but I hadn't really embraced it as a true possibility. But it now does make sense. And once that was revealed, not that I was absolutely expecting her to do it, but when she did it, that part of things did fall into place.
Mm-hmm. So I think that maybe we're still. What gets me is that I still don't think that this show is what people think it's going to be. And we're this far into it, and I still think people don't know how to react to it.
Yeah.
It's why I'm glad that the show got renewed, because I was a little afraid that people's inability to get around the fact that, no, this is not Lost. That's what I was saying before. There is no mystery, per se. It's an exploration of how messed up these people are in this post-departure world. It's not about, voice, what are the voices about that the father is hearing? No, the guy's freaking nuts.
Yeah.
So is his son.
And he's passed it on to his son.
Exactly.
These things are usually genetic.
is it almost an extremely self-aware post-Lost kind of show that Damon Lindelof is intentionally playing with his own legend in a little bit? Maybe.
Yeah, I think there's certainly an element of that, and that seems strongest here. I mean, with the Dean and Patty talking about, I can't find anything on you. You're a ghost, and him saying, oh no, I'm more of a guardian angel. That was like, oh yes, you're just trying to get people to jump on that.
it definitely is. To me, it's a fascinating character study, and this episode just kept going with that. And if there's one thing holding me back from giving it more, it's just that it is so unremittingly dark.
Yeah.
Even for me, it's just I feel drained after watching this show.
Mm-hmm.
And
I despise it. I catch it when my wife watches it all the time, and I'll catch bits of it. I get up into the room and leave.
I can understand, because certainly, we've discussed enough shows and the tone of the kinds of shows that you enjoy. And that's why when we saw the pilot, and Emmett and I saw it before you did, and we both said, no, this is not your kind of show.
And I watched it, and you were right. And it's unremittingly bleak.
I can only imagine, what the book must be like. And I'm only going to imagine it because it's the same reason that I didn't read The Road. I'll sit through an hour and a half or 2 hours of the concept to try and, just get my head around what the idea is, but I'm not going to invest in immersing myself in it to that extent of reading it. As a weekly series and kind of this meditation on the abyss, it does work. It's just, I feel like it almost goes so dark that it's to its own detriment.
Mm-hmm.
Even for people who enjoy this kind of material.
Yeah, and I had been meaning to bring it up a couple of weeks ago, but I will bring it up now because it's also timely in a way. There is another show out there that's been delving into into dark matters and doing very interesting character studies, and that's Sundance's Rectify, which just finished up its second season, and dealing with a death row convict who gets exonerated and he was convicted at age 18, comes out 19 years later, having to try and figure out what he's going to do with his life. Since it came out, people have commented on how it's kind of slow, it's dealing with this very bleak subject, but does it with some wonderful writing and superb acting, and definitely has a lighter touch than The Leftovers does. So there is a little leavening of at least quirkiness, if not outright humor, in there. So for anybody who's watching The Leftovers, and wants something that's a bit of an antidote to it, it just finished its second season, and so DVDs will be coming out. Sundance will of course repeat it eventually, but it is definitely worth seeing, and it's only 16 episodes over two seasons. So.
Well, and just to kind of get back, it was one of the news items that I neglected to put on the list only because I wasn't sure that anybody was really interested in it, but Rectify did get picked up for a third season.
Yes.
And is it Is it Jason Momoa that's the lead actor in that one?
No, it's Aidan Young, who is known primarily for his work in Australia, although he's actually Canadian. He lived in grew up in Toronto, but they left when he was like 9. So
was he on Game of Thrones?
No.
I could have swore that they said that the guy from Rectify was from that, but now I have to look it up before we wrap this up. But yeah, obviously, that's kind of our discussion about The Leftovers. And funny, it says right here on the IMDb, Rectify, people who like this also liked The Leftovers.
Yes, of course.
Funny how that works. Yeah, I was completely off on that one. I don't know why my head went there, but let's see. Yeah, I don't know why I was thinking it was Jason Momoa. Maybe there was something, some kind of weird intersection there in the news that I was reading.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a strong Deadwood influence because the writer creator played Reverend Smith on Deadwood, and anyway.
Yeah, exactly. We get so used to things being slightly incestuous in terms of one show or another that it's just. Speaking of. Before we, like I said, we're wrapping up a little bit of a longer episode, but we're going into a little mini hiatus here, so we might as well go ahead. We were talking about Manu Bennett previous to starting the recording of this particular show. I had no idea. He plays Azog the Defiler, the main orc antagonist in the Hobbit movies.
Ah.
Never in a million years would have guessed that was him under all those prosthetics, but makes sense to me, I suppose. But again, just an example of how actors from different projects wind up in some very strange places.
And that those were prosthetics, not motion capture?
I thought that I was reading that it was probably a combination of both. But at any rate, yeah, because I know The Hobbit, they're doing a lot more motion capture than they were in The Lord of the Rings, so it's probably a fair point. Regardless, yep, that's it for right now. And, yeah, the next episode is probably going to be, hopefully, a little bit of a look at what happens when a bunch of us get together in real life, the one place in the real world.
Yes.
First time ever. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Can you imagine we've been doing this for more than 4 years, guys, listeners? First time that all of us will be, hopefully, fingers crossed, able to get into a room.
Yes.
Without Skype. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And the good news is, yes, Google can't drop us.
Yes. Unless, of course, everybody would like us to just record on Google just for a little
bit. That's right. Yeah, we are each going to be in a separate hotel.
That's right. We'll actually do it over the bad cell reception.
Yes.
All right. Until we are back from our respective journeys.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.